This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Coming up, correspondent Tom Wilmer visits with Scott Collins, executive director of the Housing Authority of San Luis Obispo.
The fastest growing demographic of homeless folks in our state and our county is our seniors.
Also, on Playing with Food, we'll explore a local favorite berry.
So an Olala berry is a crossbred berry that is two-thirds blackberry and one-third red raspberry.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, July 29th, 2024. I'm Carol Tangeman. You may have heard this on NPR last Friday.
One of Mexico's most notorious drug lords is now in U.S. custody.
El Mayo Zambada. This man is important because he is believed to lead one of the most important factions of the Sinaloa cartel, one of the biggest exporters of synthetic drugs in the world, and that includes fentanyl, which kills tens of thousands of Americans each year.
According to San Luis Obispo County's website, Health Agency Director Nick Drews says, with the widespread availability of fentanyl in our communities, it's vitally important for people not to use illegal drugs that can be laced with this poison. KCBX's Stu Soren helps us get some answers to questions about fentanyl.
While we normally explore issues that just affect our local community, today's an exception. We have a return guest to discuss a topic that should concern all of us. Our discussion today is going to be about fentanyl. And our guest is Patrick Hanley. Pat is a former federal prosecutor and current criminal defense attorney. He's been a lawyer for over 36 years, spent 3 years practicing civil litigation, 15 years as a federal prosecutor in Sacramento, and the last 18 years as a criminal defense attorney specializing in white-collar criminal defense. Pat, welcome.
Hi, Stu. Thanks for having me.
So in full disclosure, Pat is a friend of mine, and not long ago, somehow our discussion turned to fentanyl. I was fascinated as Pat talked and realized how little I know about the drug and invited him on again for a discussion that we hope you will find insightful. Pat, tell us, first of all, how have you learned so much about fentanyl and what's your involvement been?
Well, Stu, throughout my career as in criminal defense, both on the prosecution side, on the defense side, I've come across all the drugs that are found in the illicit market, how they're sold, how they're packaged, how the dealers deal with them, the chemistry behind it, their effect on the human body, and I've had to do that as part of my work.
So as a federal prosecutor, you were actually dealing with crimes involving illicit drugs?
Correct. Not fentanyl at that time. At that time, it was the basic drugs of cocaine, heroin, and methamphetamine.
And in your work, Pat, who are you typically dealing with?
Well, DEA, the Bureau of Narcotics Enforcement, sometimes the FBI, but I also had to deal with the chemical side of the drug cases involving chemical analysis of drugs, the effect of the drugs on the body, sometimes the amount of drugs that would be a lethal dose. These all came up in drug cases in federal court.
So you've got a well-rounded background actually on both sides, both prosecution and defense.
Yes.
Okay. So let's start with the beginning. When we talk about opioids, what is an opioid and why are they so addictive?
Well, opioids are what they call a central nervous system depressant. And so people take opioids for pain. Okay. They've been around the United States for decades, and they're used in surgery. They're used for post-surgery pain, and they're fairly common. Oxycodone, hydrocodone, things like that are known as opioids, and they're classified as Schedule II drugs in federal court.
So then what is fentanyl?
Fentanyl was around or invented roughly in the 50s. And it has been used in the United States legally for years by doctors and surgeons during surgery. And post-surgery patients who have pain will take, for example, a fentanyl patch. And it basically depresses your central nervous system, gives you a kind of a feeling of euphoria, and it reduces your pain. But it can be very addictive.
And any opioids are going to be very addictive.
That's correct.
When did fentanyl and how did fentanyl become a problem here in our country?
Well, the fentanyl crisis arose at the tail end of the general opioid crisis involving OxyContin. OxyContin became a prevalent pain medication for use, and it was prescribed very heavily by doctors, and so people began using a lot of oxycodone. The government felt that that was a problem, so as they cracked down on the oxycodone problem, because drug dealers were buying up people's unused oxycodone and selling those on the street, and those actually were leading to overdose deaths simply from taking too much oxy, which is a very powerful cancer pain drug that was being prescribed to people for just everyday pain post-surgery or after you've had some type of an injury. So to crack down on the oxycodone, when they did that, the market, the drug market, the illegal drug market, which is very agile, they moved to find another source of opioid to use to fill that lack of oxycodone market, and that's when fentanyl entered the picture.
And fentanyl entered the picture as an illegal drug. We've left the legally manufactured drugs that are prescribed by your doctor, and now we've gone to a street drug.
Yeah. So as so often happens, the illegal drug market abhors a vacuum. So when there was an opioid vacuum and users could not get oxycodone, legitimate oxycodone, they turned to the street for a different type of drug. The market through China was producing its own fentanyl, not the kind of fentanyl we use here in the United States. They produce fentanyl, they ship it into Mexico, and it's produced by the cartels into pills and then brought into the United States and then sold here in the market.
With none of the controls that we have for manufacturing legal drugs.
Right, exactly. So the problem we have now is that when you buy an opiate, say hydrocodone or oxycodone, you go to your pharmacy and get that. That's produced by Johnson & Johnson or whatever company. They have quality controls. And it's very tight controls. You can only have a certain amount of the opiate in that pill to make sure that people don't overdose. The pills that are on the street now are being made in some guy's tub in Mexico and mixed up and pressed. And if you have 100 what they call blues or M30s, and they're actually blue pills that have an M on one side, a 30 on the other, you're not going to get a blue oxycodone pill from your doctor or your pharmacist. So they're called blues. And if you have 100 pills, one pill might have hardly any fentanyl, and you could take a bunch of those. Another pill might have so much fentanyl it kills you the first time. There's absolutely no quality control. So that is the danger of these street drugs. You don't know what you're getting. It's coming up from the cartels in Mexico, but it's being made by people who are not chemists or pharmacists, so there's no quality control. So there's no standardization of how much fentanyl goes into those pills. I always liken it to the example of, you know, would you buy a tuna sandwich from somebody? You met them online on a social media site, and they were selling tuna sandwiches, and you bought it from them, and they met you in a parking lot somewhere and sold it to you. Would you buy that tuna sandwich? And you'd probably say, well, I'm not going to buy that tuna sandwich because it might make me sick.
Right.
Because I don't know what's in it. Well, that's exactly what's happening in the illegal drug market. Those pills, nobody knows what's in those pills, and they're very dangerous.
You're saying the basic fentanyl product is being manufactured in China.
Yes.
Do we know, is it legal manufacturing? Does the Chinese government approve of this?
Well, the Chinese government, as they so often do, gives lip service to the fact that they're cracking down on fentanyl production in China. But our government just recently produced a report where they found out that the Chinese government is actually subsidizing with benefits, tax benefits, to the companies in China that are producing the illegal fentanyl powder. Right, which is what it's called, fentanyl. There's another one called xylazine, and there's another one called like nitrazine. These are all algorithms of fentanyl. Those are the powders that are being manufactured in China, and then they're shipped in powder form to places like Mexico, where the cartels manufacture these illegal, dangerous pills.
So, Pat, I'm sure that the United States is not the only place in the world that's buying these illegal pills.
Correct.
So the cartels are supplying them all over the world.
Correct. I think we're the largest market or one of the largest markets for illicit drugs in the world. It's not necessarily being snuck into the United States. It's being sent into Mexico, and they're making up the pills, bringing them into the United States. NAFTA, it's very difficult with all the shipping coming in from Mexico to the United States, very difficult to search all of those trucks, and that's how they get the fentanyl into the U.S. in the form of these pills.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to KCBX Issues and Ideas. I'm Stu Soren, and our guest today is Pat Hanley. We've been discussing the local and national fentanyl crisis with Pat, who is a former United States prosecutor and currently a criminal defense attorney. Taking a step backwards and looking at the big picture, the war on drugs.
Yes.
Do you want to address that for a minute in terms of your perspective and what you see? I mean, you've worked with our federal agents. What's your perspective?
Well, we do have a war on drugs. We're not winning the war on drugs. We've never won the war on drugs. And the problem is it's twofold, really. There's a gigantic market for illegal drugs in the United States, and it's immensely profitable. Until you squash the demand or you stop it from being so profitable, you're always going to have a demand for drugs. And to give you an idea of the demand for drugs on the street, one of the more popular drugs right now, the newest one is called Trank. That's a pure horse tranquilizer. It's not even an opioid, just a tranquilizer. And so they're finding that on the streets now. And there's another drug, the short name on the street is called ISO, which is 20 times stronger than fentanyl. And that has made its way onto the street because the street is very creative in finding new ways and new types of drug to use. And so you're always going to have people that want to use these types of drugs, whether they're opioids or cocaine. I mean, heroin now has become kind of like a passe drug. It's still in use. But the opioids that you're seeing in the street today are ever increasingly dangerous. And then now this new drug, Trank. So that's the market that's driving the drug war. And you're never going to win the drug war until you do away with the demand. And I don't think you'll ever do away with the demand.
So, Pat, let's talk about how it's being distributed in the United States. So the path is we go from China to Mexico and then we get into the United States. And how's it being distributed?
Well, you have your basic drug dealer networks where people have a street dealer that they go to buy whatever drugs. So there's street sales, but the new marketplace for drugs really is social media. Everybody's on social media. All the kids are on social media. And the kids know what social media website to go to or which app to go to find drugs. And so they'll go on a particular application, social media application, and they'll get the name of somebody that their friend has told them, that person is selling Perks, or that person is selling Xanax, or they're selling hydrocodone or oxycodone. Now, that's not necessarily true. Those people aren't selling those drugs. Those are name brand drugs. What they're selling are fake drugs that have some amount of fentanyl in them, but they appear to be Xanax or Percocet or hydrocodone or oxycodone. So then they get the person's social media handle. They go on that person's social media site and they ask them for the drugs. It's totally open. And then the person hits them back and says, yes, I got that. For example, you can buy basically 25 fake Oxy pills for about $200. And those pills will have varying amounts of fentanyl in them. All of them could kill you. They'll meet them in the parking lot based upon this social media discussion, all of which is right there in the algorithm. And they'll meet the person there. They'll give them $20. They'll get 25 pills.
Are these social media companies that are indeed legitimate businesses in this country?
Yeah. I mean, you would know who they are. If I gave you their names, you'd say, oh, yeah, I use that.
Huh.
Contact my friends. We set up tennis or we met dinner dates or we do that.
Is there no liability legally?
Well, there's currently big lawsuits by the parents of young people who've bought drugs on these social media sites and died. I think there's 50 families who have sued claiming that the websites, the social media sites, have liability for allowing drug dealers to post their wares on their website. And when you go on these websites, it's right there in the open.
Wow. You just mentioned lacing. So why are they lacing real heroin with fentanyl or other drugs with fentanyl?
Heroin is expensive. Fentanyl is cheap. They're taking cheap fentanyl and they're even putting it in cocaine because it's all a powder substance, right? So if you've got powder cocaine and you want to have more powder cocaine, you put some fentanyl in there. Now that's going to decrease the stimulant effect of cocaine, but you know, some people like that. It's actually even been found in marijuana. So sprayed on marijuana. Now I don't know why they would do that, but so fentanyl is very pervasive in the illegal drug market.
So tell us about an addicted user. I mean, what is a day's supply and what are the costs? And if I'm an addict, what do I need to get typically through a course of a day?
Well, now that all depends. In my previous example, a case I'm familiar with, 25 M's or blues or M30s, 25 M30s cost $200. So roughly $10 a pill. And that's roughly what you're spending on the street now, give or take. The high from a pill like that, assuming it doesn't kill you, that high will last, you know, 8 to 15 minutes roughly in there. So if you're trying to stay high all day long, you could need 10 or 20 pills a day. So you could be spending a couple $100 a day. Now, remember, any one of those pills at any time could have too much fentanyl in it and kill you. That's why it's so dangerous for people, young and old, to buy these pills from somebody that it's not a pharmaceutically registered or controlled drug. You have no idea how much fentanyl is in there. That's why when you go to the hospital, I mean, they carefully administer that drug. So they know your body weight, and they only give you enough fentanyl to decrease the pain or to get you through the surgery. If you're buying it from some guy off some social media site that you meet in a parking lot outside of the Vons, I mean, your chances of surviving that are not good.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to KCBX Issues and Ideas. I'm Stu Soren, and our guest today is Pat Hanley. We've been discussing the fentanyl crisis with Pat, who is a former United States prosecutor and currently a criminal defense attorney. So I guess the question now becomes, what do we do? Now, back in the early days, heroin users, there were methadone programs where they were given legal substitute drugs. Can you go there? I mean, is that an option for fentanyl for some of the other people that we're talking about today?
Sure. Opioid addiction is something that, like any addiction, you know, you can go to treatment centers and get off of the drug. I mean, opioid dependence is such a problem now that there's an industry, not a cottage industry, a large industry of companies and people that help people get off of the addiction of opioids. For example, there's a place called the Isaiah House in Kentucky that I'm familiar with from working on a case where they're trying out a new device called the NET, N-E-T, where they implant electrodes in your brain. The FDA is now looking at the NET device to see if that's something that could be a valuable tool in helping people beat drugs. Now, the other methods are, you know, tapering off of the opioid use to a point where you can just, you know, over time, but that takes more time. This NET device is, I think, really promising.
So, Pat, we've talked about the addicted users. What about the recreational users? I mean, obviously, that's got to be a market in and of itself.
Yes, Stu. So, recreationally, people have taken opioids on the weekend or they're having a bad day and they have access to opioids. So, they'll take them because it depresses your central nervous system. It's relaxing, gives you a sense of euphoria. You know, if you smoke marijuana, you get a type of euphoric, relaxed feeling. You feel good. And so that is the casual user of opioids. Now, when you combine that with the danger of an opioid that's made in Mexico by some guy in his bathtub who's mixing it with fentanyl, and you have no idea how much fentanyl is in that pill, the casual user can kill themselves the first time they take that pill. But so you have the casual user who's just recreationally, just like people recreationally smoke marijuana, they'll recreationally take an opioid. Somebody will say, hey, you want an Oxy? Oh, sure. And they'll take an Oxy. And then you see a lot of stories around the country where somebody went to a party and they're having a bad day, so a friend offered them an Oxy. And this will relax you. Oh, sure. But in fact, it was a fake pill that had fentanyl in it, and they died. So that's the recreational user.
Okay.
Then the addicted user is somebody who's maybe been in pain management for an injury they had, and they had to take a lot of opioids and became addicted. And then when their opioid supply from their doctor was cut off because they felt that they were using too much, they went to the street to fill that opioid addiction, and then that puts them at risk for these fake opioid pills that have fentanyl in them.
Which creates greater and greater demand all the time.
Right, exactly.
What's being done now legally? I mean, obviously, you said we've lost the war on drugs. We're not going to be able to keep them out of the country. What's happening in local communities in terms of enforcement, in terms of sentences? What's happening legally?
Well, so the local district attorney's offices in every county, the program now is if someone, let me back up a little bit. Historically in California, if you sell a street drug, just a basic hand-to-hand street sale between a willing buyer and a willing seller, if you sell drugs to someone and they died as a result of the use of the drug, that was simply an involuntary manslaughter charge, which is roughly 2, 3, or 4 years in state prison. They didn't charge murder for that back in the past. Now, the goal is, in order to stop the sale of fentanyl in our communities, the local district attorneys, even here in San Luis Obispo, are charging second-degree murder, which is rare. It's unusual. Has not been tested in the appellate courts. To my knowledge, there's only been one trial in Riverside where someone was convicted of second-degree murder for selling fentanyl to somebody who died. Under the law, really, that's an involuntary manslaughter charge because you're doing something that's inherently dangerous. And to prove second-degree murder, you would have to prove that there was a complete lack of care for the or concern for the life of the person you're selling the drugs to. And I don't think that people are going to be able to meet that standard in the Court of Appeal. They might, but that's a very high standard. Most drug traffickers obviously don't want their clients to take whatever they're selling and die because then their client base is gone. So I think that's a hard standard to meet, but that's what the law enforcement community is doing. They're charging second-degree murder in an effort to send the message to drug dealers out there, if you sell fentanyl in our community, you're going to face a murder charge. I mean, recently in San Luis Obispo, they did that. A young woman went to trial and the jury would not convict on the second-degree murder charge. And so she ended up pleading to voluntary manslaughter and they got 7 years for that. But really, law enforcement, what they do when they see something like this happening, the carjacking is a good example. People used to steal cars at gunpoint all the time, became very violent. So they enacted the carjacking statute in federal court with very stiff penalties. And that's the philosophy, is that if we make these people go to prison for a long time, they'll stop committing that crime. That really doesn't work because the market, the demand is so great and the profitability is so fantastic that the drug dealers are willing to risk a second-degree murder charge, which is 15 years to life in prison.
Pat, can't tell you how much I appreciate your coming in.
Thank you, Stu.
I'm Stu Soren. Our guest today has been Pat Hanley, who is a former United States prosecutor and currently a criminal defense attorney.
Now, earlier this month, Governor Gavin Newsom signed a new law mandating California school districts, charter and private schools with existing health classes to teach high school students about the risks associated with fentanyl. The courses will be introduced in 2026 and will be mandatory for graduation. And the San Luis Obispo County Behavioral Health Department, in partnership with the Slow County Opioid Coalition, conducts regular outreach events to educate the community on fentanyl dangers, overdose prevention, and effective responses. Check the county's website for information. You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Carol Tangeman. Up next, correspondent Tom Wilmer visits with Scott Collins, executive director of the Housing Authority of San Luis Obispo County.
Scott, last time I saw you, you were working for the city of Morro Bay.
Right.
And you have a whole new life now.
It's a big change from 2023. Now we're here in 2024 working on housing.
What's your position?
I'm the executive director for the Housing Authority of San Luis Obispo County. So we provide housing to folks who are on the low income end of the spectrum.
Would that include Section 8?
That is correct, yeah. Now, that was like the old term. It's called housing choice voucher, but for most people, Section 8 rings a bell. So we provide vouchers to about 3,000 families in our county.
What does that do for them?
So what that does is it gets them to that elusive gold standard of paying 30% of your income towards your housing cost. That used to be an achievable target. It's becoming harder and harder to achieve for all income levels, particularly those at the low income. So we provide a subsidy through the federal government whereby the individual has a voucher never pays more than 30% of their income. So if they make $1,000 a month, they're paying $300 for rent. It may cost $2,000 a month.
But right? Utilities on top of that?
They usually get a discount on utilities. So it really helps stabilize families, seniors, veterans.
These are people that were marginalized right on the edge of
right.
Going unhoused, as they say today.
That's right. We have a lot of people in our community who are eligible for this service, but we are restricted by the number of vouchers we can provide based on the federal government's budget. We'd love to offer more, but we are very efficient in the allocation we're provided and proud of the fact that we serve 3,000 families now. for every one family that has one, there's probably four or five who are also eligible but can't get one. That's where we look to other partners, but folks do fall through the cracks, and that's why people are sometimes mystified by how much money is being spent to address homelessness, yet the numbers either are stagnant or get worse. It's because more and more people fall into it than we're able to help get out of.
Somebody in your industry the other day was talking about the cost to manage and deal with a homeless person is more than to house them.
Correct.
That's really interesting.
It really is. You think about somebody living on the street. I know we're talking more about affordable housing, but there's a connection. Based on my prior work as a city manager, working with police departments and fire departments, hospitals, et cetera, the cost of the system of somebody being unhoused is significant, far more than, you know, the subsidy that we provide or that shelters provide or interim housers provide or subsidies that keep people from falling into homelessness. It's far better to get ahead of it upstream.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Looking forward, if you could paint your own picture and you had a bag of money and you could allocate it anywhere, free will, what would you do?
Right. Well, I think there's money and then there's policy. On the money side, I think trying to find that balance between the shelter services and interim housing, because not everybody's ready to go right into housing. To get people stabilized, we need them to be off the streets. So making sure you have enough money there, but then really thinking about the long-term play that we want people to be permanently housed, then you need to have enough units. So making sure there's money spent there, because what we're finding in some parts of the state, other places in the United States, is that you have shelters, but you have no permanent housing. Mm-hmm. So they're sort of held forever.
Kind of warehoused.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's not a long-term solution by any means. So I think, again, also putting money in preserving housing and keeping people housed, a dollar spent there is significantly better than, you know, the money that you'd have to spend to keep somebody in a shelter. And I know police departments and fire departments would much rather spend their resources on addressing crime or other life safety issues than some of these quality of life issues. You know.
I think it's Reno and a couple other places have been very successful at their housing, at creating little tiny houses. Talk to us about that big picture and how you might apply that here.
Yeah. Tiny homes, villages, things like that have been proven to be successful, particularly in transitional housing where, okay, you want somebody out of a congregate shelter so they can have their own unit, begin to kind of get their life together, work with case managers to get Social Security or other benefits, also prepare for work or get their children back in their lives if they've had drug abuse issues or mental health issues. All those things become easier to deal with when somebody has their own space. But those aren't meant to be permanent, but they can serve as a nice bridge, right? And so there's projects in South County, and then another one just got approved by the Board of Supervisors up here in San Luis Obispo for something very much like that. Like Cabins for Change, for instance, down in River Beach.
There's
20 or 30 units there. And it's prefabricated, much more cost effective than, you know, building brick and mortar.
Yeah.
But it's not meant to last forever, of course. Yeah. And then a similar approach being proposed up here on Bishop and Johnson by the county facilities there to do both transitional and permanent housing. And developers or service providers come to us to provide vouchers for those permanent units to help provide the services. Because you do need to pay staff at the end of the day to help these folks. Getting them housed is key, especially if they have some acute issues like drug abuse or alcoholism, but they still need services after they're housed to begin to address those issues.
Let's look at the county broad picture. Are there pockets in the county where there's a preponderance of homeless, or is it kind of equally distributed?
I wouldn't know all the data exactly, but I would say there's a mix between North Central and South County. And thankfully, there are agencies working in each of those locales. And the coordination is getting better with the county, the Homeless Services Division, which is a new thing that was started a few years ago. It was birthed after the adoption of their 5-year plan to address homelessness. So there's better coordination between the service partners, but also getting a data system in place so you sort of know where people are before. It was, these systems would not talk to each other, so you could have people on five or six different lists and a lot of confusion, and it's hard to track outcomes, right, which we know how important that is when we're spending, you know, millions of dollars of taxpayers' money. So those things are all getting better, which is great. But I would say it's kind of equally placed throughout the county, the homelessness issue. But it's great to see the county taking leadership.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Go back to broad brush scope of your mission here, the Housing Authority, priorities and the breadth of what you guys do here.
Yeah, so the two main focus areas for us are the voucher program, which I mentioned earlier. That's allocated from the Housing and Urban Development Department of the federal government, or HUD for short.
And how do you connect with the recipient for the vouchers?
So we have a cadre of staff that you walked by when you came into our offices who are housing specialists. So they work with people who have applied and have been lucky enough to been selected through the lottery system. And then you begin the process of income verification. That's the key piece, right? That your income qualified. If you make more than typically 50% or 60% of the area median income, then you're not qualified for housing. That's our main target areas, those who are in that 50% or below. And then once we've verified those in their income, then they have a voucher by which they can go onto the private market and work with landlords to try to find a place to live. We spend a lot of time building relationships with landlords, because without them, we can't make the system go. We have agency, sister agencies in other parts of the state, won't name names, but where they're only able to maybe execute about 80% of their vouchers. So 20% is left on the table.
And why?
Because they can't get takers.
Right? Interesting.
Because there's still, for some, a stigma attached with Section 8.
So there's resistance.
Right. And the state is trying to leapfrog in front of that and help create regulations that reduce discrimination, but this still happens, right? So it's on, onus is on us as a housing authority to build those relationships. The partnership or the linkage is between the tenant and the landlord. We don't intervene. But if there are issues, landlord reaches out to us. We have case managers to try to help assist our tenants if they're having episodic issues with, you know, mental health or other issues. But
you guys have outreach? Or you leave the headquarters and go out in the field?
Yeah. We have resident services which is the other part of our house, is the projects that we own and operate that help. But then we have case managers who are here to assist those clients who are maybe working with an individual landlord and may have issues. We do our best to help them. We also partner with Capslo, Echo of North County, Five Cities Homeless Coalition, with them to help get some of their clients into our voucher system. VA, a big connection there for veterans. So all working together kind of address the same issues. The other part of what we do is we build and operate affordable housing projects. So that's a...
So actual construction.
Yeah, actual construction.
Under your umbrella.
Becomes part of our ownership under our nonprofit.
Give us a word picture of where it would be, what it would be.
The big project, there's many underway now, but the one big project underway is the Anderson Hotel, which is downtown San Luis Obispo.
That's a major building. Deal. Yeah.
It was a hotel for the stars back in the day. It's a 100-year-old building. The 60s, 70s, it sort of lost its luster, and then they began working with us, leasing the building for low-income housing.
So it could be the whole breadth. It could be a senior.
Right, anyone.
Any disability.
Right. Exactly. Mm-hmm. But, you know, a few years ago, the owner was considering selling the hotel to a private hotel developer to, I think, tear down or maybe renovate. I'm not exactly sure. But
how did you – was it right time, right place?
I think it was. A lot of factors in play. It was middle of COVID. It was right after the – federal government, Congress had passed the ARPA, which was the American Rescue Act. They're flush with cash. The state was investing in money into individual care, individual units for homeless to get away from congregate care because of the concern of the spread of COVID-19.
What will be the population?
So there'll be 66 units, and we're targeting primarily homeless or formerly homeless individuals or those who are at risk. That's a permanent deal.
And the units would be like the SRO, single room occupancy.
Yeah, they're either studios or one bedroom.
But they have each have their own bathroom.
Right.
And how about cooking?
Everything, all soup and
self-contained.
Nuts. Yeah, we usually can't place people into anything less than that.
Mm-hmm.
Again, that's when you fall back into that temporary or transitional. So this is permanent housing, and then we have case managers who will work with this population, plus our maintenance and property manager who will live on site. It looks like a typical apartment, but then we're also connecting a lot of these folks to services.
Ancillary services that could be ideally on site.
Right.
Is that going to happen?
It's for these folks only. So it's not a shelter. Yeah, I don't want to put that out there. It's not a magnet for other folks. It's literally for those on site only. But we would have partnerships, for instance, with Slow Food Bank or County DSS or alcohol treatment or, you know, AAA or all those kind of things we would bring on site. So Social Security, like we have a list of 2 pages of folks that we help connect people to.
A lot of that is just practicality. They don't have cars necessarily.
Right. But we have people who were part of that population that we temporarily moved them into other facilities. And most of them who have the option want to come back because they like that freedom of being able to get around downtown. You know, it's a pretty cool place to live. And the building looks amazing. I don't know if you've seen it recently.
Walked by it a week ago. It looks like you're getting close.
We're really close.
What's an ETA for grand opening?
Well, we hope to get people in September and then, you know, some kind of grand opening ceremony in October. But this was one of those projects, back to your question, that sort of came together at the right time. You had Congressman Carbajal coming in saying, hey, how can I help? Let me see what kind of money I can provide. You had the state stepping in. You had the city and the county. And they all asked Haslow to intervene so that this could be maintained as permanent supportive housing.
That's really cool.
Really cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Home run on that one.
Very much, but a very challenging project all the same. And it's nice to see it done.
So looking forward, that's all up and running in the future. Then what? What do you have your eyes on? Where do you go from there?
Let's see. We have about 3 or 4 other projects underway. We have the old Maxine Lewis site, which was the home to the first emergency shelter in San Luis Obispo.
Oh, yeah, the old,
yeah,
the kind of Victorian-era house.
So that house will be maintained.
What is it right now?
Well, it was kind of storage, different odds and ends. It was our property, so we sort of kept things odds and ends there, but that house will remain, but then we're building 40 units of permanent supportive housing.
Little bungalows?
It'll be a, you know, standard apartment,
two-story,
but it will house those who are homeless or formerly homeless or at risk.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have a family project on Bridge Street, which is over that way. Listeners can't see me pointing, but you know, it's in San Luis Obispo, just trust me. And that's a 31 unit for families. We have a project completing in Pismo Beach or Shell Beach. That's a 24-unit senior facility. One of the things that I learned, which was eye-opening, I think we all sort of have our idea of what homelessness looks like, but the fastest-growing demographic of homeless folks in our state and in our county is our seniors. And that's, you know, sort of look at the math, it makes sense. A lot of folks are retiring with Social Security or less than, and that's simply not enough to pay rent. Yeah, like I said, we have a lot of projects we're working on. We completed one in Morro Bay.
Oh, yeah, I was going to ask you about that. There's kind of delay in moving. What happened there?
Project was tricky to begin with. I was working for the city when it was approved. But when construction began, or before, we knew there was challenges. Cultural resources, Native American cultural resources on site. So there was a lot of coordination with the Salinan and Chumash tribes.
They had a village right there.
There was just a lot of stuff there, you know. And so sort of having to move, reconfigure the layout of the project.
Mm-hmm.
But then we became victim of the supply chain snarl, and we were months behind in receiving our switchgear, which serves to power your project. At the same time, you have all these supply chain issues. you're also instituting new regulations or incentives to encourage all electric homes, right? Which is great because it reduces your CO2, but everybody wants this all at the same time. Yeah. And there's less supply because of the supply chain. So it created this perfect storm where we were delayed by 6 months.
So now it's up and running. And what population
primarily? It's family. It's a family project. So we have three types. Mm-hmm. We have family, senior, and then special needs.
And total population?
About 1,000 units we own and operate throughout the county.
But the one in Morro Bay?
Morro Bay is a 40 units. It's all family.
So it might be 100 people? Or
yeah, less. Probably. Yeah, we have ones, twos, and three bedrooms. Mm-hmm. Yeah, mixture. A lot more we're seeing interest in the one bedroom mm-hmm. or studio. Again, that's back to the senior.
Going forward on that subject, what's your near-term vision for more projects like that?
Well, we are working on trying to close a financial deal for a 50-unit senior apartment on the corner of Monterey in California. This will be eye-popping.
That's that empty field right now?
Empty field. It'll be a five-story facility, which will really change that corner, but mm-hmm. it's an elegant design project. And then we're also trying to do the same closing on a 63-unit right off the highway on North Oak Park Road, Royal Grande.
That doesn't exist yet.
Doesn't exist
yet. Empty field.
So, we're creating new housing. You know, I know you're talking to me, but, you know, if you talk to people self-help housing who are very much involved in our community, they're kind of building at the same rate. Mm-hmm. So it's
to see Habitat for Humanity.
Habitat does a different model where it's home ownership, and they kind of do ones and twos and three, mm-hmm. sometimes 5 to 10 units at a time. But also, they're doing great work. And then we also have Paso Housing Authority. They don't do vouchers, but they do build housing.
That are subsidized.
They're focused entirely in Paso. They have about 300 units that they own and operate. So we've got a lot of activity going on in our county, and we try to collaborate together. Mm-hmm. I mean, we compete with each other for funding, but we really try to, where we can, partner. For instance, we're partnering with People Self-Help Housing on a project in Grover Beach, land donated by a family that had been there for many generations. They thought it would be a park, but in talking with the city felt maybe be more inclined or more useful to use that land for housing. The family agreed. So we're underway a 53-unit family project there, which, thanks to the good work of our team and People's, we were able to preserve a 300-year-old oak tree.
Oh, cool.
Really cool to see that come together.
Well, we're out of time. I know you have another meeting. Scott, I really appreciate you sharing with us.
For sure.
To learn more about your world, where would you direct us?
Yeah, check out our website. It's haslo.org. You can always email me at scollins@haslo.org if you have any questions, or if you want me to speak to any groups, please reach out to me. Happy to talk about what we're doing. And I also encourage people to pay attention to what's going on at their city councils. We need housing for our folks who are on the low-income spectrum, but we need more housing of all types, and it's important that people share their thoughts and opinions with planning commissions and city councils. My name is Scott Collins.
Scott, thank you so much.
Thanks, Tom.
You're listening to KCBX Public Radio. This is Issues and Ideas. I'm Carol Tangeman. Up next, Playing with Food.
This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. I'm Father Ian Dellinger, and I'm playing with food. If you know what an ollolliberry is, then the end of this short conversation probably sounds familiar. How long have you been picking them here?
Since I was a child, probably since I was 8 years old. The pies we eat immediately, but the jam we make for holiday gifts.
So when you talk about ollolliberries to other people, do they know what they are?
No.
We'll get to what an ollolliberry is in a bit, but first let's pop down to Lompoc, where my sister-in-law Margaret is growing ollolliberries. I'm assuming that these berries here are the ollolliberries?
These are ollolliberries.
Okay. How long have you had these berries?
Just over a year.
Did you plant them from seed?
No, little plants.
Where did you get those little plants?
Oh, Benton ordered them online.
Benton said that you grew up eating ollolliberries. I have discovered that not very many people know what ollolliberries are. Are they easy to grow?
Yes. I mean, these were little plants that were maybe 3 inches when we bought them. And they grew a lot last year. And then everything that grew last year has berries this year. The new growth this year will have berries next year.
You're down here in Lompoc, and I was told that it likes the cool and the fog.
They do very well in the Santa Cruz area.
Okay, so that kind of makes sense. It's similar weather here, isn't it?
Yes.
Do you know other people who know what ohlone berries are?
I don't think so.
There it is again. People don't know what they are. I wanted to get the full scoop on an ohlone berry, so I went to Cambria, where the berry is famous.
My name is Brandy, and I work at the bistro at Lynn's Restaurant.
When people come in and say, what's an ohlone berry? What do you tell them?
So an ohlone berry is a crossbred berry that is two-thirds blackberry and one-third red raspberry. They started growing it up in Oregon at the university, and that's when in the 1940s.
Why is Cambria famous for the ohlone berry?
Well, way back when, John and Renee Lynn, who started the restaurant, moved out here from Kansas, and they had a bare patch of land, and they decided to grow some ohlone berries, and she started making pies. And everybody loved them, and that grew into this business.
Cambria has a lot of tourists, right? And I'm sure a lot of tourists come into your restaurant, into the bistro. Do you get a lot of questions, people wondering what it is, or do people usually, you're so famous they already know?
If you're from Europe or a different country, we get a lot of questions. If you're from the West Coast, some people tend to know because the berry only grows here on the West Coast and up in Oregon and Washington. So if you're from the East, people usually don't know about it. So we do get a lot of questions.
If you are just tuning in, you missed what an ohlone berry is, but never fear, it's worth repeating. There's an ohlone berry you-pick farm near Avila Beach, so I knew that the farmer could tell us what an ohlone berry is.
My name is Jake Smith. I am farmer, owner, operator at Avila Valley Barn.
Today we're looking at ohlone berries. What's an ohlone berry?
An ohlone berry is a variety of blackberry. It's a cross between a young and a Logan berry.
What's a young berry and what's a Logan berry?
Oh gosh, now we're getting into parentage. I can't go that deep into the parentage. I do have a family tree of it in the office up at the barn, and it shows all the way from the original varieties that were bred. And then, you know, it's an actual family tree as it goes down. There's probably 7 to 12 varieties that go into the final, after generations of breeding, bring it down to what is today a ohlone berry.
How do you breed berries? Do you just like mix them in a pot and then stick it in the ground?
You do a cross-pollinization, and then you would plant the seeds. For the ohlone berries, what they would do is they'd have one variety, they would isolate the flowers, and then they would pollinate with a different variety, and then take the seed from that fruit, and then plant that seed, and you would get a mix of the two varieties. And then you would do that over years. It's not a quick process. It's a really long process of finding just what you want, because you're going to get a different composition of those genes of the different parents into the fruit itself. It's a coastal variety. It really likes the fog, the cool springs, that June gloom, so it doesn't have much notoriety. But here on the Central Coast, it's a fan favorite. If you're from San Luis Obispo or anywhere along this western seaboard, you probably at least heard about it somewhere.
So it's kind of like the Pinquinto bean of berries.
Yeah, a great way to put it. It's a finicky berry, you know, it's got a short growing season. You can only really harvest off of it for a couple of weeks. It's not the best for commercial uses. It's really good for home gardens and pick your owns and these local mom and pop shops where you're actually going to get the fruit ripe off the vine. It's not like they're picking them green and then letting them ripen in storage and then shipping them across. They're not great shippers, but they're great eaters. Okay. So
we're looking at some vines here, and these are all trellised. They look really easy to pick. What I am in awe of is there is a lot of berries on these vines.
Yeah, we have a bumper crop this year. Everything's looking really good. Those wet winters that we had just really got us through, and everything's looking great. We'll be harvesting every day for a couple of weeks here now.
How long have these vines been here, and how long are they going to last?
These vines right here have been in, this is going to be their third year. We have another set that's just up the road a little bit. Those ones we just planted last spring, so they're in their first leaf in the ground here.
Do they produce right away?
No, so there's primacane fruiting and floricane fruiting berries, some that will get fruit on their first year canes. The berries that we're standing at right now, there's canes that are running along the ground that are not on the trellis. These are actually next year's crop. The long runner, the whole branch itself is a cane. These are all cane berries. Oh, wow. We trellis them. They don't climb. We have to put them up ourselves. So what we'll do after harvest, the canes that are on the wires, we'll cut those ones off right after harvest, and then we'll put all these runner canes that are on the ground, we'll put them up onto the wire, and then next year they'll flower, and that'll be our crop for next year. So they're alternating annually from the floricanes and the primacanes, and then they'll do that every single year. So these plants, you do not get fruit your first year of planting. You'll get it the next year.
Okay, and how long do they last?
You know, our last set we had for about 16 years. That's a long time to keep them in the ground. You know, the curve of yield starts to decline between the second and fifth year. A lot of the commercial guys will replant much more often. We kind of just keep them in as long as we can, as long as we're getting good yields and the customers are happy and they're leaving with berries, then we'll go through and replant. They're a very strong fruit. You know, you see them growing on the side of the road. They look like weeds. They're just bomb proof. As long as you're taking care of them, they're going to be okay. You could cut out a whole plant next year. It'll still grow from those roots.
Speaking of the brambles that you were talking about, you know, when you come across a bramble on the side of the road and you try to pick it, you're going to come out with a bloody hand.
Yeah.
Right? These don't seem to have as many spikes, but they do have spikes, I see, but they don't seem to have as many spikes and thorns as traditional blackberries and raspberries. Is that true?
They do have thorns. They're a thorn variety. Yeah, not nearly as many as like the raspberries. Those things, you know, if your hand touches that cane, you're going to feel it. We do especially tell people to be careful. Keep your eye on the berry that you're going for. If you blindly reach in there, you're going to probably catch something you don't want in your finger. Not for lullaberries, but for other varieties. They do have thornless varieties. So we've planted actually a couple thornless raspberry varieties that we're trialing out this year.
It looks like the trellising makes it easier and less bloody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Also increased airflow. You really want to get them up off the ground. Just makes it much easier to harvest and cleaner crop. So we're pretty much looking at the whole entire crop on the plant right now. You can see the black ones that are going to be ready right now. We're picking today, starting our U-pick. And then the green ones, 2 to 3 weeks, those ones will be harvesting. And then that's kind of the end of the crop. Again, really short season for lullaberries.
Is there one ripe enough to try?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Okay. Anything that's dark enough. I was turning on irrigation and I probably ate 2 pounds of these yesterday. So get in there. They're a tart berry, great for pies, great for baking with. They're not going to be your typical blackberry. You're actually going to get that little feel in the back of your jaw when you bite into them, but that's kind of what makes them great for baking with. And I love them fresh off the vine.
Okay, here we go. I'm going to try one. They are tart, but nice.
Yeah. And the darker the berry, the sweeter the fruit. You'll definitely notice if it's got a little tint of red on there, you're definitely going to taste it. If you find them jet black, that's where you want them for the day you're going to eat them.
You say they were great for baking. What other uses do they have?
Parfaits, smoothies. They go great for jams. It's a great single varietal jam. Anything that you can, if you want, add a little bit of sweetness to will really balance them out. On ice cream, oh man. Hard to beat.
And you just ate them plain and off the vine.
That's how I prefer them. Our pies are something special to have. I've been eating them for 38 years now, and so the pies I try to stay away from, but the fresh fruit I can't get enough of.
There's just so many berries.
Yeah.
So many berries.
They are loaded. In about a month, again, we'll be going through, and all these ones that are up on the wire, we'll cut them down at ground level. We'll remove those canes from the field. And at the same time, all these runners that are on the ground, we'll put them up on the wire.
How do you propagate these vines? You said you just planted some new ones. Can you plant the actual berry and it will grow?
We buy our planting stock from a company out of Washington, and we get plants that are already propagated. I believe they would start from a seed, just like most fruit. A lot of them will do from cuttings. I believe it's called totipotency. They are really vigorous growers. So you can actually take the tip of one cane and just poke it in the wet soil, and that will actually start developing roots and plant itself. Caneberries are actually a great one to just take a cutting of. You can root it yourself at home and then plant that growth right there.
When you dispose of the stuff that you cut off at the end of the season and wherever you put them, do you ever end up with voluntary vines?
No, what we'll do is we'll actually cut these all up, put them in the center, we'll flail mow them instead of like your regular lawnmower that turns horizontal to the ground. The flail mower will actually chop up the canes and make really small pieces, and then we'll actually disc that and incorporate it back into the soil. Carbon sequestration, adding organic material back to the soil. If something's really bad, if we have a real big issue, then we'll remove it from the field, but generally we'll just reincorporate any kind of cuttings. Actually, my family, we moved here in 87 onto the property, same house I live in now, actually. Okay. My family was always on the retail side of things. Dr. John DiVincenzo owned the property, and my mom worked with him for 30 years, and unfortunately he passed in 2009, and his family all had their own operations and things going, and they ended up making my mom partner in 2010. That's when I started farming and just kind of started poking seeds. I've been around it my whole life. In ownership, we decided to divvy up jobs. So my brother, my twin brother, runs all the food service here at the Avila Barn. And then my wife, Raven, all three of us are co-owners and we keep the operation running, second generation.
So can I get a few berries?
Yeah. Yeah, just having the customer out on the farm. Opportunities like this are few and far between these days. So it's part of our goal and our whole vision for the Avila Valley Barn is to bring the community onto the farm. Let the kids interact with the animals and the fruits and the vegetables. A lot of kids don't even know what a corn plant looks like nowadays. So when the community gets to come out here and really get their hands in the dirt and their, you know, their lips on that fruit, we're making lifelong connections with food and family and community.
Here we are picking. So you pick one, eat one, pick one, eat one?
Yeah.
Is that how it works?
It's a one for one, for
sure. Okay. Here's a whole bunch right together. Now, is it typical that they don't ripen in clumps? They don't seem to be ripening in clumps. They seem to be ripening like one here, one there.
So they will get little flower clusters. You can kind of see this little branch. We'll have anywhere from 2 to 5 berries in this little cluster off this branch. So they do cluster, but not quite like you would imagine, like a grape would grow on a cluster.
I kind of frighten myself for picking that I'm going to get punctured. The red ones look so tempting and beautiful, but you're saying...
Oh, you can try one. I eat them all the time when I want to just get a little pick-me-up.
Okay, I'm going to try one. Ooh, they're very firm.
They're firm.
They're very
that
firm.
One's very red. That one will be tart.
You're warning me right now. Here goes. Oh, wow.
Yeah, and as they go, you can see the progression from green to a pale red to a dark red to a purple, then to a black. And those are going to be all different levels of ripeness.
These don't ripen off of the vine?
They will continue to a little bit, but nothing in comparison to when you pick them full ripe, vine ripe.
How many people will be out here this afternoon?
Oh, you know, we've never actually counted, and it, you know, changes by season and day. Opening weekend for Lullaberries, we certainly are hoping for a good group of customers to come out today and this whole weekend, and again, for the next 2-3 weeks, we'll be harvesting.
This is KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Father Ian, and I'm learning about olaliberries. Lynn's restaurant has some olaliberry items on the menu, and Jeff and I enjoyed a few.
So we have a choice of olaliberry desserts. There is the olaliberry cheesecake, olaliberry bread pudding, almondine, and the olaliberry pie.
I think you definitely have to do the olaliberry bread pudding because it comes on the recommendation, and then it would be criminal not to have the olaliberry pie.
So we should have both?
How are we doing, you guys?
We're going to start with the chicken olaliberry sandwich, and then olaliberry bread pudding almondine, and a slice of olaliberry pie.
I'm not a chicken sandwich kind of guy either, and I don't usually do fruit and meat, like almost never.
So this is an adventure for both of us. Have you had olaliberries before?
I do not believe I have.
Oh, here comes the sandwich. Here comes the sandwich. This looks amazing, and I was wondering what the slaw would look like, and it is purple. Okay, let's take a bite and see what happens.
That's good. It's really good. It's really good.
I don't normally do fruit and meat, but this is good. That slaw is good. Here we go. Here it comes. 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 Ooh, look at that. This right here. Right here. Okay, thank you.
The bread pudding looks awesome. I can't wait to taste it.
Bread pudding. That's very nice. What do you think?
Very good. I'm getting notes of raspberry.
Should we try the pie?
Sure. That's very good.
It's a little bit of cherry, but also blackberry, raspberry. It's very nice. It's not too sweet.
Yeah, I prefer the bread pudding.
I liked the pie the best because it's berry forward.
And I like our crust. Our crust is made with lard, so it's an old-fashioned, very traditional crust, and it just makes it so good.
We learned a lot about olaliberries. I ate some fresh berries with yogurt, my sister-in-law made an olaliberry crumble for the 4th of July, and Jeff was definitely sold on the berry.
I'm going to stop and get some olaliberry curd.
More people should know what olaliberries are. Here at Playing With Food, we've done our part. Lynn's Bakery, Lynn's Restaurant, and Lynn's Berry Farm are doing their part. And Jake at Avila Valley Barn is doing his part, too.
But here's what you really need to know about olali berries and any type of berry.
It's really interesting because they're tart, but there's something about a fresh berry that just, that makes you feel kind of like...
alive.
Yeah, I was going to say the same thing. Like, yeah, and... alive and outdoors and all this kind of stuff, yeah. You know.
Go out there, get some berries, and feel alive. This is KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Father Ian, and I'm playing with food.
You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eyster composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Carol Tangeman. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments. KCBX.org.